Ladera had asked. He knew all of this in the 8th grade? Well, how did Capus say he was going to kill himself?
Easy. Capus said he wouldn't even consider suicide. It was the coward's way out, and he preferred to stay and fight through whatever problems he faced.
Oh, noble man, Ladera said.
You're prejudiced, Mike said.
It's true, she said. Poor Jordan. He must have been far more miserable than we ever knew.
It'll make a great scene, Mike said. But I knew that Capers was the central figure of all of us who had drifted on the surfboard that night. Capers lived perfectly contained within his own deep dream of himself as a work in progress. He was the only one of us who actually observed himself in the various stages as he made his way through life. Self-doubt was unknown to him. He always knew exactly where he was going, and he was a master of all the fine points of coastal navigation. We would discover that later, when we accidentally got in Capers's way. We came out of that summer with our friendship sealed, but the story of our friendship would bear bitter fruit, and would one day bring tears to the eyes of all those who loved us well.
Part 4, Chapter 22. Fantasy is one of the soul's brightest porcelains. As the day rapidly approached when I would take Leah into the forsaken realms of my past, I felt the floodgates of recall open up in a ceaseless flow. As a travel writer, I had specialized in the artistry of my own escape from what was most intimately mine. I had kept my eye on the horizon and fled all calls for the careful study of my own nest. My entire professional existence depended on the sincerity of my clean break with the past. The world was my subject, and my hometown was the stimulant that drove me out to seek the world. In my head shimmered the lights of 1,000 strange cities and towns, which I could recall in glamorous detail, and I could speak easily of ports where peppers and tangerines arrived in open-air markets, piled in black boats, or of smoky bazaars where young girls were sold as prostitutes and monkeys for meat, or of places where men told stories over tarot cards in languages that seemed to have no vowels. But Waterford lay buried, and many of its stories moved through my subconscious. Deep within myself, I could hear the distant oratorio forming as I pieced the fragments of my past together like a piece of music and shared them with Leah. Leah had cherished the few stories of Waterford I had told her, perhaps because she instinctively knew that they were opening up a history where one day Leah would discover herself. I had always told her that there was nothing more beautiful in the world than a story, yet it is I who had reigned as the chief censor in the text of her imagination. In the 3 months before our flight to America, I tried to tell Leah everything that might help her understand and survive the trial by family she would now endure. And as the stories unfolded, Leah would often seek out Ladere and listen to Ladere's version of the same remembrance. Ladere's memory was often harsher and more piercingly focused. With Ladere, Waterford sounded like the county seat of an all-suffocating decorum. My Waterford loomed as a masked ball with the twin themes of lunacy and surprise. Taken together, a two-steepled skyline began to form in Leah's mind. On the transatlantic flight to Atlanta, I took a leather photograph album out of my briefcase, a special one that I had kept under lock and key during those years I kept her past hidden from her. I opened it and showed her pictures of my grandmother and grandfather in front of their caretaker's house on the Isle of Orion, photographs of her uncles, and I gave small, intimate biographies of each as our plane sailed through a brilliant aquamarine sky. A careful, dutiful child, Leah memorized the names and faces of all her relatives, near and far.
"Who is this, Daddy?" Leah asked, looking at a faded Kodachrome.
"That's me and Mike Hess and Capers Middleton in first grade."
"You're littler than I am now," she said.
"That's the way time works," I said, as I studied the image of myself taken over 30 years before. I could remember the moment that Capers's mother had taken the photograph, and I could remember the taste of the pecan sandies my mother packed in my lunchbox every day that year.
"Who's that?" I asked.
"My pretty little dog," Leah said.
"Not just any pretty little dog."
"That's the great dog Chippy?" Leah cried out. "But, Daddy, she's so small and cute. I thought Chippy must be the size of a St. Bernard."
"No," I said. "She slept with me on my pillow every night. My mother would come in, kick her out, and banish her to the downstairs, but Chippy'd always be there when I woke up in the morning."
"Is that Mama?" Leah said, pointing to a sad-eyed, overly dressed girl.
I nodded. "It sure is. That's third grade, and she'd come over to show my mother her new pair of saddle Oxfords. That's why she's pointing at her feet."
"Daddy, I'm so excited," Leah said, squeezing my arm. "I never dreamed I'd meet my family. Do you think they'll like me?"
"Oh, they'll eat you up with a spoon."
"Is that a good thing?" Leah asked.
"They'll love your little Roman ass."
"Bad word, that's 1,000 lira.
"Not now," I said. "We're going to land soon. Now it's a buck."
"Is Ladere meeting us here?"
"No," I said. "We go through customs in Atlanta, and she'll be waiting for us in Savannah."
"Are you excited about going back to live in Waterford, Daddy?"
my daughter asked. "I'm terrified," I admitted, and then added, "but at least it's quiet in Waterford. Nothing much happens there."
"Everything happens in Waterford," Leah said, and I saw that she was speaking directly to the photo album. Before landing, I looked down at the green hills and hidden lakes of Georgia and tried to address my anxiety. Then I watched my daughter move back and forth among the photographs of my past and realized that I had raised a child with a longing for any rumor of home and that I would have to put aside my own fear. Ladere met us at the Savannah airport and drove us straight to Elizabeth on 37th for a dinner that I had arranged before I left Rome. I'd already begun to worry about how to make my living as a travel writer when my travel was going to be limited to day trips from Waterford, but my editor at Food and Wine had told me about a new generation of Southern cooks who were both classically trained and dedicated to revolutionizing the fundamentals of Southern cuisine. I was told they all preserved their fondness for grits and barbecue, despite their desire to sneak goat cheese into the tossed salad. In the handsome, high-ceilinged Victorian outside of the historic district, I went back into the kitchen to interview Elizabeth Terry and her staff as they prepared redolent and beautifully constructed meals for tables of conservatively dressed customers. She told me the names of all the leading chefs who were most intimately connected with the new transformation of Southern cooking. That first evening back in America, we ate a light, superb meal that would have been impossible to find anywhere in the South except New Orleans during the 70s. Leah dined on pasta amatriciana, which she pronounced delicious, and wondered aloud why her father told her she would never again eat good pasta until they returned to Rome. I admitted my error and described the years I had labored as a food critic, tasting ghastly combinations of pasta and sauce in Italian restaurants from Texas to Virginia that all deserved shutting down by the health department at best, a firebombing at worst. Later, we spent our first night beneath the South Carolina sky at the house on the Isle of Orion that Lucy had rented for us. Ladere had gotten the keys earlier and had done a preliminary inspection of the premises and found the house far more than adequate. It was built on a high bank overlooking a saltwater lagoon. As I walked through the house for the first time, I was pleased to see that the owners, a Mr. and Mrs. Bonner, had selected their furniture and paintings with great care. They were people of good taste, people I would like to know, I thought, as I studied a wall of family photographs where the Bonners strutted their children's blonde good health and their straight, toothy smiles that spoke so eloquently of the orthodontist's art. The kitchen was adequate, and Lucy had already stocked it with food. In the master bedroom, I found a writing table and a four-poster bed that I would have bet was a Bonner family heirloom. Upstairs, I heard Leah squeal with pleasure as she discovered a bedroom to her liking. I unpacked her suitcases as Leah took a shower. Taking care not to wrinkle the clothes that Maria had so sadly and lovingly folded, I filled up an antique dresser and laughed out loud when I discovered the 3 boxes of pasta and the whole salami Maria had packed in case the Americans failed to feed Leah in the proper manner. I made a mental note to call Maria in the morning and let her know we had landed safely and that Leah had eaten pasta that had met with her approval. Leah walked out of her newly claimed room in her pajamas, sleepy-eyed and smelling of powder. She was asleep before I got past the first sentences of a story. I found Ladere lighting a fire she had already laid in the fireplace. She had fixed me a drink and handed it to me as I watched the flame consuming the dry oak.
"To your homecoming," Ladere said.
"This could turn out to be hell, but it's decorated nicely," I said, looking around.
"Why don't you use a radical approach and try to enjoy your time here?" Ladere suggested.
"Please," I said. "You must try to humor my existential anguish."
"You'll have plenty of time for that," Ladere said.
"Mike called, and he'd like us to write an outline of the miniseries in a month. He told me to tell you no more excuses, and he wants a note from your doctor saying you actually got shot in the head by a terrorist."
"I still feel uneasy about the project," I said to Ladere. "How can we write for Mike without hopping into bed with capers?"
Ladere said, "The subject's fascinating, and I think we can learn things about ourselves we don't know. We can recapture some of the magic of the good, lost times."
"It's dangerous to write about what you don't know," I said.
Ladere got up to go and said, "It's dangerous not to."
I woke much too early the next day, and when Lucy came by the house, she found us watching a televangelist warning his audience that Armageddon was almost here, due to the licentiousness and evil of mankind. Lucy cooked a large breakfast for Leah and lied to her when the child asked her the meaning of the word licentiousness. I clearly corrected my mother's error. After breakfast, Lucy made sure that Leah was dressed warmly enough, then took us both for a first long walk on the Isle of Orion's 4 Mile beach. The tide was out and the water flat as we walked on the beach gathering shells and examining the barnacle-covered driftwood that had washed up during the previous night's tides. The day was windless, and even the seagulls had to stroke their great wings to keep aloft. The ocean mirrored the sky, and few swells or ridges disturbed the brown pelican floating 20 yards away from us. As we walked, Lucy showed Leah all the safe spots for swimming, and where the water grew treacherous and riptides moved in fierce turbulence. She explained to Leah that if she were ever caught in the undertow's grip, that Leah must allow herself to submit to the undertow rather than fight against it.
"Allow the undertow to take you out to deeper water, darling," Lucy said. "The undertow is weak out there and it will let you go. Then you can just swim slowly back toward shore and catch a wave all the way in."
Together, woman and girl studied the detritus tossed in random piles near tide pools. Lifting the broken shell of an Atlantic blue crab, Lucy pointed out the deep blue coloring along the torn claw. "The most beautiful blue in all of nature." Leah was so filled with delight and curiosity that the walk continued for hours as Lucy shared all the knowledge of the literal she carried with her. They collected what shells they could find, but only the coquina clams were plentiful on the beach. Lucy promised a cornucopia of them when the spring tides began and the ocean really began to warm up.
"Shells? We'll gather the most beautiful shells the Atlantic has to offer, the rarest, too. But we've got to be vigilant. We've got to work hard. We've got to commit ourselves to coming out here after every high tide."
"We can do it, Grandma," Leah said. "Daddy told me you could teach me everything there was to know about the sea."
"He knows some things himself," Lucy said modestly, but pleased. "Of course, I'm sure he's forgotten most of it since he took it on himself to become a European. Come over here, child. Let me show you how erosion is eating up this beach."
On the seashore, Lucy had found the text of all creation, imprinted daily on the sands of the Isle of Orion. By walking the beach each morning, Lucy had strengthened her belief in God and come to understand that she was no more important to the planet than the smallest plankton that floated in the invisible broth that served the softest orders of the food chain. It had helped Lucy when she could think of her own bloodstream as an inland sea, not much different from the one that she and Leah walked beside. Her leukemia was similar to the virulence of red tides that attacked southern beaches during the summer, causing fish kills that made the seabirds crazy with gluttony. A beach was a fine place to come to grips with all the cycles of the universe. It eased her fear of dying. She watched Leah's pretty run down the beach toward the carcass of a small shark. The crabs and gulls had already done their small-scale butchery. The shark's eyes had been picked out, and a larger predator had removed part of the dorsal fin.
As her granddaughter ran, Lucy told me that she would teach this child everything, and tie her to the South so completely that I could never take her back to Italy. I gave her a look, then let it go. After we came in from the beach, I drove Leah the 18 miles on Seaside Road, in the oversized Chrysler LeBaron that Lucy had encouraged my landlord to leave for me. We touched 5 sea islands before we crossed the J. Eugene Norris Bridge into Waterford proper. Even when I was recuperating in Rome, I had imagined making this tour with Leah, and had practiced the itinerary in my mind, choosing with care which streets I would drive her down and at which houses I would stop to reveal their histories. I took a ride after the bridge and drove slowly past the mansions of the planter class, who had built their houses facing east toward the sun and Africa. Spanish moss hung from the water oaks in such smoky profusion that the houses looked like chapels seen through veils. Labrador retrievers slept on marble steps. Brick walls, inked with pearly lichen, hid carefully tended gardens from the common view. It was the neighborhood where both Shala and I had grown up, and its streets seemed to disappear into a field of lost time and drift like childhood itself. We drove down Porpoise Avenue, past the stores of the main shopping street with their 18th and 19th century facades, crowding both sides of the street. Once I could close my eyes and name all the shops and their owners on both sides of the street, but modern times had brought an influx of strangers to town, who had opened up health food stores, office supply shops, and banks with unfamiliar names that had merged with giant financial institutions from Charlotte. I also noticed that the names of the oldest, most honored law firms had changed their aristocratic shingles to reflect the death of managing partners and the rise of feisty young attorneys who wanted their own names engraved on the signage of Porpoise Avenue. When we passed the Lafayette House, I pointed out the shingle of my father and brother, McCall and McCall, attorneys at law. Luther's Pharmacy had closed, the Huddle twins had given up their barbershop, and the Breeze Theater was now a fashionable men's shop. Lipsitz's shoe store was where it always was, and its mere survival seemed a necessary corrective amid the change. When we came to Russoff's department store, I told Leah that was where we would find Max, the great Jew. Then we drove to a poorer section of town, and I showed her a small brick 2-story building that had been the store that the great Jew had opened when he first moved to Waterford. We drove past Waterford High School and the football field where I had played fullback, and both Shala and Ladere had been cheerleaders in that long-ago world where innocence was at least an illusion that young Southerners could cling to until the world brought them up short. Every street contained vivid transparencies of my past, and Shala's face began to appear to me in every billboard and stop sign. And I understood that I had come back to go face to face with Shala for the first time since she died. As we drove down to Marlet Road, named for the French explorer who had first landed at Waterford in 1562, I pointed out the Waterford River, caught in brief glimpses between the houses built along the high bluff. I once had been able to name every family and the children who had lived in each house we passed, but death and mobility had scrambled the deck and made the certainty of my memories suspect. Finally, we drove up to the entrance of the small but well-cared-for Jewish cemetery, a half-mile from the town's center. It was surrounded by a vine-covered brick wall, and oak and cottonwood trees provided shade and comfort as I swung open the iron gate decorated with the Star of David. I led Leah by the hand, walking through long rows of tombstones decorated with Hebrew letters that were a roll call of all the Jewish names that had followed Max Russoff to Waterford. I stopped before one of the graves, and when I read Shiloh's name, it took my breath away. I had not returned to this graveyard since we buried Shiloh, and seeing Shiloh Fox McCall made me cover my eyes with my left hand. The word McCall looked out of place in this acre of Shines and Steinbergs and Kaiserlings. "Oh, Daddy," Leah said, "it's Mama, isn't it?" I had expected to comfort my daughter, but I fell speechless. The shock of Shala's death had quickly turned to its details, then to a trial to decide the fate of our child.
That pain had rendered me tearless, insensate. Though I felt thunderstruck, I still could not cry, but only stare. I stroked Leah's hair as she wept. Finally, I said, "This is the wrong cemetery." Leah answered me, "I knew you'd make a joke." "I'm that predictable?" I asked. "Yes, you always make jokes when you're sad," she said. "Tell me a story about Mama," Leah said finally, kneeling down to pull weeds out of the pale winter grass that covered the grave. "What's your favorite?" I asked. "Tell me one you haven't told me before," Leah said. "I can never really see Mama. She never seems real." "Have I ever told you a story about how your mother used to drive me crazy, how she could make me angrier than hell?" "No," Leah said. So I told Leah the story of the black woman in Charleston who Shala had found in an alley near Henry's furniture store. Shala had the heart of a socialist and the soul of a missionary, and she spent a lifetime unreconciled to human or animal suffering of any kind. Shortly after we were married, Shala was shopping when she came upon an unconscious black woman, covered with sores, lying in an alley. Shala walked into Henry Popowski's store and asked that Henry call her a cab, which he gladly did. Then she had to cajole a most reluctant cab driver into helping her lift the prone body of the anonymous black woman into the back seat of his cab. At the end of the cab ride, she again coaxed the driver into helping her carry the woman into the one-bedroom carriage house we had rented behind a Church Street mansion. When I arrived home from my job as restaurant and movie critic for the News and Courier, we had one of the bitterest arguments of our marriage. Shala contended that no human being would leave a poor, helpless black woman passed out in an alley surrounded by a racist white society. I argued that I would be more than happy to pass up such an opportunity. If that were the case, Shala screamed, she had certainly married the wrong man, and she would soon be looking for a husband who was far more humane and compassionate than I was. But I thought compassion had nothing to do with the fact that a black drug addict, covered with sores and smelling like a billy goat, was lying in the only bed in a one-bedroom apartment. I also contended that we'd be evicted as soon as our racist landlords found out that they had added a black hooker to their roster of tenants. Shala shouted that she would not conduct her life to conform to the wishes of racists, nor would she have married me had she known I was a secret Nazi. "Nazi," I had yelled. "I complain when you bring an unconscious heroin addict and put her into my goddamn bed, and suddenly I'm in charge of all the crematoriums at Bergen-Belsen. Every time I argue with you, I start out on King Street in Charleston and end up at the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin, leading my Nazi youth boys in a spirited rendition of the Horst Wessel song." "If the shoe fits," Shala fired back, "wear it." And neither one of us had noticed that our guest had awakened until we heard her say, "Where the fuck I be?" "You be in my fucking house," I said to her. "And you're welcome to stay for as long as it takes to get back on your feet," Shala said sweetly. "I'll be damned if that's so." "My husband is a racist bastard," Shala explained. "Don't pay any attention to him." The black woman, disoriented, said, "You people kidnap my ass?" "Yeah," I said, irritated. "We left a ransom note in your grandma's outhouse." "Racist to the core," Shala shouted, beating her fists against my chest. "Racist scum. I go to bed each night with the chief cyclops of the Ku Klux Klan." "Good," I said. "That's a step up. From Auschwitz to Selma in a single goddamn leap." "You're the fucking Klan man?" the black woman asked. "No, ma'am," I explained, trying to control myself. "I'm not in the Klan. I'm just a poor, godforsaken white man, underpaid and underappreciated, who'd like you to remove your pus-covered body from my bed."
"Racist pig," Shala screamed. "You're what gives white southern males, masters of oppression, a bad name." "Got that right, honey," the black woman said, nodding her head.
"Our guest agrees," Shala said triumphantly. "She's not our guest," I said.
"If I ain't your guest, what the fuck am I doing here?" the black woman said.
"Sisterly togetherness," Shala said. "What a beautiful thing."
"Can I take a bath?" the black woman asked.
"Of course," Shala said. At the same time, I said, "Certainly not." "Did you forget we were invited for drinks by my publisher?" I asked.
"I certainly did not," Shala said sweetly,
and I'm ready to accompany you to that Neanderthal's house.
"Do you mind if we don't take your new friend, Harriet Tubman?" I asked, faking civility.
"I have to go to a party with my soon-to-be former husband," Shiloh said. "You take a bath and pretty yourself up. Here's $10 for a cab. Leave your name and address, and I'll take you to lunch next week."
"I personally am not leaving this house until this woman is out of it," I said.
"Yes, you are," Shiloh announced, "or I file for divorce tomorrow. The first divorce in South Carolina history caused by white racism."
Shiloh rushed out of the carriage house, and I, eyeing the black woman suspiciously, followed her out the door. When we returned from Mr. Manigault's party, the black woman had bathed, fixed herself a meal, then stolen all of Shiloh's clothes, shoes, and makeup. She packed it all up in the leather luggage Shiloh had bought me for my birthday. On her way out, she lifted the sterling silver from the secretary near the doorway. Then she called a cab and cheerfully re-entered the underworld of Black Charleston. I chuckled at the memory as I stood over Shiloh's grave with Leah.
"We laughed at that story more than anything that ever happened," I said. "We'd go to some new, strange town in Europe, and your mother would whisper, 'Where the fuck I be?'"
"Did the police ever catch the woman?" Leah asked.
"Your mama would not let me call the police," I said. "She claimed that the woman needed all the stuff more than we did. She was glad the woman took it. I wanted the woman to be enrolled in leather tooling classes at the state pen."
"Mama didn't care that the woman stole her clothes?" Leah asked.
"I used to see the woman sometimes, walking around in Shiloh's clothes," I said. "I'd be off covering a story with a photographer, and I'd see her working a stretch of territory near the Cooper River Bridge, and I'd have the photographer take a picture. Shiloh used to love it that I kept those photographs in an album."
"Did she get new clothes?"
"Well, she drove straight to Waterford, went to the Great Jew, told him what had happened, and came back to Charleston with a whole new wardrobe. She could always depend on Max."
"Were you mad at Mama?" Leah asked.
"At first I was furious, naturally. But everything that happened was in perfect character for Shiloh. I could have married 100 South Carolina girls who'd have walked over that woman in the alley, but I married the only South Carolina woman who'd have brought her home."
Leah stared at her mother's name for a long time before saying,
"Mama was a nice person, wasn't she, Daddy?"
"A sweetheart," I said.
"It's so sad, Daddy," Leah said in a whisper. "It's the saddest thing in the world. She doesn't know anything about me. She doesn't know what I'm like or how I could have loved her. Do you think she's in heaven?"
I knelt down beside my daughter, and the earth was hard and cold against my knee. I kissed her cheek and brushed the hair back from her face.
"I know what I'm supposed to say to make you feel better," I said, "but I've told you. Religion confuses me. It always has. I don't know if Jews even believe in heaven. Ask your rabbi. Ask Sua Rosaria."
"I think Mama's in heaven," Leah said.
"Then so do I," I said, and we walked hand in hand out of the cemetery, pausing to look back at Shiloh's grave once before we got in the car. I would always remember that visit to Shiloh's grave as one of the hardest things I had ever done in my life. I grew angry with Shiloh again, but kept that anger to myself. When she leapt from the bridge, Shiloh never considered the day when I would have to bring our daughter to mourn her loss at graveside. There were so many things that Shiloh hadn't thought of. From the cemetery, we drove back down Perimeter Road, past Wilford Curve, took a left at the eyesore of a community college, and went 4 long blocks before turning into the driveway of my childhood home.
"This is where I grew up," I told Leah.
"It's so beautiful and so big," she said.
We walked out to the dock, and I pointed back toward the town, where the river dog-legged left toward the sea. Carefully, I tried to acclimate her to where she stood, and pointed toward the sea islands where we had spent the night in our rented house, and then pointed in the general direction of Italy. Leah seemed uninterested in this geography lesson, so I quickly took her back down the dock, past the spartina grass of the marsh, that had that wintered-in look of depletion. In the cold months, the marsh slept invisibly beneath the mud, as the shoots of new grass, sharp as cut glass, began to form. The new marsh was beginning to make its move. The back door of the house was unlocked, and as we entered the kitchen, I breathed in the smell that elucidated the complex issues of my childhood. The salt marsh was part of that smell, but so was my mother's laughter, coffee grounds, the frying of chicken, sweaty uniforms thrown in heaps by the laundry room, cigarette smoke, cleaning detergent. All of them I remembered as I led Leah by the hand. We moved out through the dark hallway and into the dining room, where I took a crystal salt shaker and tried to shake some salt in my hand, but the humidity had long ago turned the contents of that shaker into a small imitation of Lot's wife. I sniffed the pepper, but it was so old it could not even make me sneeze. Upstairs, I showed Leah my bedroom, which still contained pennants I had put up when I was a kid. A dusty scrapbook, long unread, told the story of my small-town athletic career, from Little League to college. Leah pointed to a door that led to a half-hidden, top-floor attic. Like all children, she gravitated toward the room full of old trunks and discarded furniture. She discovered a bag full of roller skates and piles of strange-looking keys. Going deeper into the attic, she found an album of photographs of me taken when I was a baby. There was a clarinet and a sailboat and a box full of outdated life jackets. I let her rummage around as I sat going through old scrapbooks in a desultory fashion. The newspaper clippings had aged as I had, and when I came across a picture of Shiloh congratulating Capers after a game, leaping into his arms in classic cheerleading fashion, I felt unbearably sad and replaced the scrapbook on its dusty shelf. Then I turned my attention to the paperback books, and it seemed that not a single one had been moved from its place. This room had long served as a retreat from the disharmony and sadness of the first floor, and it was here I had fallen in love with these books and authors in a way that only lifelong readers know and understand. A good movie had never once affected me in the same life-changing way a good book could. Books had the power to alter my view of the world forever. A great movie could change my perceptions for a day. I had always kept these books in alphabetical order, from A.G. to Zola, and I had read for the way words sounded, not for the ideas they espoused. "Hello, Holden Caulfield," I said, taking the book from its shelf. "Meet you at the Waldorf under the clock. Say hi to Phoebe. You're a prince, Holden, real goddamn prince." Taking out Look Homeward, Angel, I read the magnificent first page and remembered when I had been a 16-year-old boy and those same words had set me ablaze with the sheer, inhuman beauty of the language as a cry for mercy, incantation, and a great river roaring through the darkness. "Hello, Eugene. Hello, Ben Gant," I said quietly, for I knew these characters as well as I knew anyone in the world. Literature was where the world made sense for me. "Greetings, Jane Eyre. Hello, David Copperfield. Jake, the fishing is good in Spain. Beware of Osmond, Isabel Archer. Be careful, Natasha. Fight well, Prince Andre. The snows, Ethan Frome. The green light, Gatsby. Be careful of the large boys, Piggy. I do give a damn, Miss Scarlet. The woods of Burnham are moving, Lady Macbeth." My reverie was broken by Leah's voice. "Who are you talking to, Daddy?" "My books," I said. "They're all still here, Leah. I'm going to pack them all up and take them back to Rome for you." And I walked down the stairs, went back into my bedroom, and raised the window that looked out to the roof and the garden. The wood was warped, and it took me several minutes before I could remove the screen. Then I climbed out to a flat part of the roof that gave me a view of the river and the garden. "You ever climbed a tree?" I asked. "Not one this big," Leah said. "Is it dangerous?" "I didn't think so when I was a kid," I admitted. "But now that I think about you climbing around in it, I feel faint and dizzy, like I'm going to have a heart attack."
"Is this your and Mama's tree?" she asked.
"The same one," I said. "Now the branches are so broad you can walk upright on some of them. But I want us on our hands and knees most of the time. Let's be careful."
"Were you and Mama careful?"
"No, we were nuts."
I stepped out onto a limb that touched the roof and lowered myself to another huge branch, thick as a sidewalk. I reached back and helped Leah onto the branch, and the two of us crept slowly to the center of the tree. The oak was the only thing from my childhood that never appeared smaller than I had remembered it. We made our way to a well in the trunk of the tree, where the remnants of a treehouse still provided a comfortable observation post.
Leah was thrilled. I pointed toward a smaller white house that sat at the very end of the garden. An older woman was sweeping the steps of her modest porch.
"That's Shiloh's mama. That's your grandmother, Leah."
"Can I speak to her?" Leah whispered.
"Yell down to her," I said. "Ask if we can come over."
"What do I call her?" she asked.
"Try Grandma," I advised.
"Grandma," Leah said, her voice bell-like in the great tree. "Grandma!"
Ruth Fox looked up, surprised. She took her broom and walked into the garden where she had heard a child's voice.
"Up here, Grandma. It's me, Leah," Leah said, waving down at her grandmother.
"Leah! Leah, my Leah!" Ruth said, stammering. "Are you crazy? Get down from that tree! Jack, are you trying to kill my only grandchild with your foolishness?"
We climbed down from the great oak tree, and Leah jumped into the arms of her grandmother. Ruth fell apart when she took Leah into her arms. I felt like an eavesdropper as I turned my back and saw something I had forgotten near the fish pond in the garden. Walking away from Leah, I noticed that the small stone epitaph was in bad repair. Koi and goldfish floated like chrysanthemums in the dark pond. I rubbed the worn lettering on that flat stone and made out the words, "The Great Dog Chippy." I decided that I would show Leah Chippy's grave some other day. Turning back, I saw Ruth saying something to Leah that was making her smile with pleasure. I wondered if George Fox knew that his granddaughter had come home. Then I heard music coming from the Fox house, Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a Theme by Paganini. The choice of homecoming music surprised me, because I knew that George Fox held that particular composition in contempt and thought it banal and sentimental. But I also knew that it was Shiloh's favorite piece of classical music, and George was playing it with such passion and conviction, out of homage to Shiloh and an act of gratitude to me for the return of their granddaughter to his house. The music ended, and George Fox appeared at his window, and we looked at each other. We sized each other up, and a great hatred ran like a stream between us.
"Granddad,"
I heard Leah say as Ruth pointed to her husband. Our mutual love of Leah softened both of us and brought us back into our better selves. As Leah ran up the stairs into the Fox's house, George Fox and I bowed to each other. He mouthed the words "thank you," then disappeared from view.
Chapter 23. As a seasoned travel writer, I had returned to the embarkation point, entered the forbidden city of Waterford, as though permitted voyage at last, to a severe wonderland that had killed my wife outright, and that had left me estranged from my own family and friends. In my eyes, the town was a dangerous place, riddled with cul-de-sacs and dead ends, and you could not turn your back on it for a single instant. It was my daughter Leah who returned my town to me as a favor and an endowment. She found magic in it because all my stories began and ended here, and because each day she ran into Shiloh's childhood by accident. At school, she sat in the same desk near the window where she was told her own mother had sat during elementary school. After school, she would go to the Fox's house where her grandfather gave her piano lessons, and Ruth Fox took great pride in spoiling her rotten. Leah found it odd that I had spent so much time away from a town so comfortable. Rome could tuck Waterford into a small pocket of its coat and never even notice a change in its clangorous, teeming environment. For Leah, it was like living life in miniature. Intimacy came with the territory. By removing Leah from her birthplace, I had only proved that exile was the surest way to sanctify the path that led toward home. Though I had told no one how long I was staying, I had based my whole return on my mother's health. Ladere and I worked on the movie project for Mike because the pay was good. We got to study the past at our leisure and kept learning new details that surprised us. And it offered a time each day when we could be together. I had never spent time with a woman so easy to be with for such long periods. The story we worked on was partially our own, but the more direction we received from Mike Hess, the more we realized that the disappearance of Jordan Elliott from our lives was pivotal to the success of the project. Mike seemed to think that he could fix all of our lives if only we could make sense out of the series of catastrophic events
that had divided us down the middle at so early an age. Mike carried around with him a nostalgia for a time and a set of friendships that was irreparable. Ladere and I conducted hundreds of interviews and wove together a narrative that cast light on both the miniseries and the high points of all of our lives. By asking about others, we learned thousands of things about ourselves. Yet those things we could not answer made the other half-completed and inert. Jordan had disappeared completely into the underworld of Catholic Europe. Neither his mother nor I heard from him since the day his father betrayed him in the Piazza del Popolo. Jordan's war with his father and Shiloh's leap from the bridge were the two bookends of our conflicted time together in the South. Ladere and I spent the last of winter and the first months of spring making up a timeline of all the incidents that had brought us to this state of preparation and watchfulness. We waited for something to happen that would cleanse us of all that was unknowable or ambiguous about our pasts. What we lacked was resolution, an ending. I could tell myself I had come back to write the script, show my daughter the country and the people from which she had sprung, and, maybe, fall in love with Ladere just a little bit. Only my mother knew, because of her instinctive and complete mastery of every nuance of my behavior, that I had come for reasons I could not admit even to myself, and that I would not leave until she had died. The movie became my excuse. Each morning at 6:30 before school, Lucy would meet Leah and take her for a long walk on the beach. Here, Lucy made the shoreline a text of great beauty. On early morning walks, Lucy taught Leah to recognize the eggshell of a skate, the dark triangle of a shark's tooth, the differences between starfish, and the aesthetics of shell collecting in general. Lucy's favorites were the angel wings with their folded, ethereal flamboyance, the olive shell in all its modesty, the channeled whelk, and the oyster drill for the intricacy of its seemingly accidental architecture. She had retained her girlish love of sand dollars, even though this beach was a Comstock lode of these doubloon-shaped relatives of sea urchins. Their prevalence along the shell-strung beach soon cheapened them even to Leah, but like all shells, their value lay in the symmetry of their form. To Lucy, the whole coastline of South Carolina was a love letter written by God as a literal translation of his abundant love for the beachcombers of the world. She also tutored Leah in how to recognize the signs that the mother loggerheads made in the sand when they began to lay their eggs in May. After their walks, they would hose their feet off, dry them with large towels left on the deck, and Lucy would drive Leah into town for school. Because of her illness, Lucy demanded that I surrender all mornings to her, and because of that same illness, I complied. It was another warning from my mother that her days were numbered, and that she wished to tie up all the loose ends of her life, and needed some forbearance from her children to accomplish all these soft duties with a certain amount of grace. Each day after school, George and Ruth Fox were waiting for Leah as she emerged from her classroom in town. They would walk her to their house on the point, where Ruth would fix her cookies and milk, and George would give her piano lessons 3 times a week. She played with vivacity for a girl her age, and the only thing she lacked to keep her from being great was obsession. The piano required monogamy, and Leah had far too many other interests and hobbies for her to surrender her life to the keyboard. But George was a patient teacher, and her training in Italy had been impeccable. Leah's natural ebullience was more than a match for George's attraction to darkness. The music they made together gave great pleasure to both of them. After each lesson, George would play for Leah, trying to show her what beauty could be coaxed out of a piano if someone took the time to be the instrument's servant and devotee. Every Friday, Leah spent the Sabbath with her grandparents. Ruth would light the Sabbath candles, then serve the Sabbath meal. Though I had promised Shiloh that I would raise our daughter as a Jew, I fully expected the brunt of that responsibility to fall on Shiloh's shoulders. There were few questions about Judaism I could answer easily, and no matter how many books I read, no text could illuminate the theological rainforest where the tenets of that complex and hair-splitting faith luxuriated and multiplied like papayas. I had tried to raise her to be a good Jew, but I did not exactly apprehend what constituted such a notable creation.
Together, we had learned the simplest Hebrew prayers, but I felt like an impostor whenever I mouthed the beautiful, mysterious words. I was as uncomfortable with a language that read from right to left as I was with rivers that flowed north. It was outside the natural order of things as I knew it, even though I was fully aware that Hebrew predated English by nearly 2,000 years. I was relieved that George and Ruth took over Leah's religious instruction without a word ever passing between us. Friday and Saturday belonged to them, from sunset to sunset. Though they were grateful to me, the Foxes never invited me to share one of these Sabbath meals. The history between us was still on fire. We were courteous around each other to the point of parody. Actors in the same drama, we played our parts with a certain stiffness and dissonance. All the words were pleasant, and all rang false. Ruth tried to hide the tension with her volubility and high-pitched laughter, and she fluttered like a songbird on the days when I arrived at 5:30 in the afternoon to pick up Leah. George hovered always in the background, hands folded primly. Solemnly, he would bow to me, and I would repay with my own terribly formal nod of the head. Though both of us were glad of the armistice, neither of us knew what strategies would lead us around the impasse of distrust and hatred that we both felt whenever our eyes met. For Leah's sake, we were cordial. For Shala's sake, we were no more than that. In the first month of our return, I introduced Leah to everyone who had importance to Shala's and my lives, and showed her everything about the world we had grown up in. We pored over high school yearbooks that had been left behind in the Fox's attic when Shala and I had gotten married. Pressed between the pages were mementos of Shala's high school life. Orchids from proms fell out in tough, withered petals like lost gloves of elves. She had kept the ticket stubs of movies she attended, with the names of the movies carefully inscribed, along with her date for that night. I smiled as I came across stub after stub with Jordan Elliott's name written out in Shala's clear hand. There were programs from school plays and football games and events at the synagogue. Notes that had been passed to her in class were also dated and annotated. An essay she had written about Lady Macbeth in advanced English, with its A-plus grade and its rapturous note of congratulations written by her teacher, John Loring, were preserved in the advertisements at the end of the book. "Let's see what you wrote," Leah said, flipping through the yearbook. "Oh, my God, I'm praying I didn't sign the stupid thing."
"Of course you signed it, Daddy. You married Mama."
"Yeah, but I didn't know I was going to marry her then."
"Here it is. Look, Daddy. Read it to me."
"Well, this is worse than I thought. This is horrible. I can't possibly read this when I'm sober." On a page marked "Reserved," the word itself penned in by an emphatic parenthesis, I, in my stupid, embryonic manhood, had written, "Dear Shyla, just little old me getting in line to write some sweet nothings to one of the sweetest girls in the world. Never forget fifth period English class and the way Mr. Lauren's face turned red every time you called him stud. We sure have been through a lot together, but I can honestly say it was worth every minute of it, and it was all done in the spirit of good, clean fun. Well, not that clean. When you get tired of that nasty sex maniac Jordan, you know you can crawl up the tree to my window any time. Ha ha, that's a joke. Don't forget who put the bop in the bop-she-bop, and who put the ram in the ram-a-lang-a-ding-dong. Always remember the senior trip and the time that Crazy Mike put the rattlesnake in Mrs. Barlow's car. Try not to get into too much trouble this summer, and let's get drunk together every night at the university next year. To a girl who's too sweet to be for got 10, Jack." Looking up from the yearbook, I was more embarrassed than moved by what I had written at the end of senior year. I was an idiot, a perfect jackass. Now I can understand why the Foxes hated my guts, I said. Why your mother ever married me will remain one of life's mysteries.
I think it's very nice, Leah said.
Force of habit was not one of my major virtues, but I had tried to cultivate at least the camouflage of certainty with Leah. Like most children, regularity appeased some primitive urge in her. Leah was used to having a schedule, and it gave her an inherent sense of order and time and the correctness of things. Without the presence of Leah, I feared that my travels would all begin at midnight,
and that all my meals would be completed beneath the silence and starshine of 3 in the morning. My child ensured a certain normality and provided the antidote to my natural discontentedness. Several days a week, we met my mother and Dr. Pitts for drinks at their beachfront house at 6. I wanted to spend as much time as I possibly could with my mother, and though it bothered me that I had to share this time with a relative stranger, I realized that Dr. Pitts was part of the package. For her entire life, Lucy had been searching for a man who would hang on every word she said, and who would take with utter seriousness her most flippant and random thoughts. She had found that man in Jim Pitts. He adored her. I did not wish to pass my knowledge of cold inarticulateness onto Leah. Deep in my heart, I thought that it may have killed Shyla. By coming home to be with my mother, I hoped that the glacier inside me would finally calve and break off and seek the warmth of the Gulf Stream waters that were also my heritage. Lucy had done exceptionally well in remission. Her complexion was rosy again and her health improving. We all knew this flowering as a false spring, but Lucy was inspirational in her desire to live, and her enthusiasm was catching. She was not about to surrender without a fight. I was sitting in the living room of my mother's house and watching Dr. Pitts as he made his stiff, ritualized approach that took place at 6 every evening. "Choose your poison," he said to me. "A Bombay gin martini, straight up, with a twist," I said. "And you, mademoiselle?" the doctor asked Leah. "Lemonade, please, Dr. Jim," she said. Lucy walked in from the garden and came over to kiss both of us. Her kisses were indifferent, given so casually as to appear thoughtless. She smelled like wild sage and earth. "The usual, dear," Dr. Pitts said, from the antique bar where he hovered over a row of cut glass decanters. "Love potion number 9? "Sounds divine, darling," Lucy said, winking at Leah. "You think it's time to feed the 4 horsemen of the apocalypse, Leah?" Leah checked the grandfather clock at the end of the room and said, "Yes, look." Sitting down opposite me, Lucy began singing a country song from her vast repertoire. This time she chose Johnny Cash's "I Walk the Line." She had a deep, good voice, and she loved to show it off. Dr. Pitts smiled with affection as she sang and he mixed. There was a slight movement beneath a chair at the far end of the long sitting room, and another near the drapery along the windows facing south. It took less than a minute for the 4 box turtles that Lucy kept as pets in the house to begin their slow, stately walks away from their secret hiding places. Their appearance seemed enchanted to Leah, no matter how often she had witnessed Lucy's singing invitation to them to join the rest of the family for cocktails. Their shells were etched and delicate, porcelains made from foxfire and chocolate. They looked like pond flowers moving across the room. When all had arrived, surrounded her feet, and looked up at her with that ethereal patience that seems to be the hallmark of cold-blooded animals, Lucy passed 2 bowls over to Leah and watched as her granddaughter fed the turtles raw hamburger and lettuce. The turtles were mannerly, and each waited its turn. When they finished, they turned and moved with liturgical grace back to the underworld of the house, as Dr. Pitts timed their exits to his appearance with the drinks. "I tried to sing rock and roll to them once, Leah," Lucy said, taking her vodka tonic from her husband, their eyes meeting quickly. "It'll put hair on your chest," Dr. Pitts said, moving from Lucy to Leah, who took her lemonade with thanks. "But the turtles didn't budge with rock and roll," Lucy swore. "Then I tried Christmas carols. Nothing. Because of Dr. Jim, I sang the Navy hymn. No turtles. And then I sang the Wabash Cannonball, and those turtles came out of the gates like racehorses. These are pure country turtles, and they respond to country rhythms. Nothing else moves them." "It's true, Leah," Dr. Pitts said. "I'm the chief witness for the defense. Wouldn't mind signing an affidavit to that effect. Man's got his word, and that's the most precious thing, don't you know?" He handed me my martini, and like all ex-military men that I had ever met, Dr. Pitts fixed a perfect one. "Here's blood in your eye," Dr. Pitts toasted, lifting his glass, "and fire in your belly." I had noticed in my time home that most of what Dr. Pitts had to say was either ritualistic or purely social in nature.
He was gentlemanly enough to know he was required to speak on occasion, but sensible enough to know that his best strategy during cocktail hour was his deference to his wife. He liked to say of himself that he was a man of few surprises, but what he meant was that he thought of himself as boring.
"Finally, there's going to be some activity around here," Lucy said to Leah. "Not a thing of consequence has happened since you arrived on the island, but that's all about to change."
"What's going to happen, Grandma?" Leah said, walking over and sitting in her grandmother's lap.
I watched as my mother's fingers ran easily through Leah's black hair.
"Big doings," Lucy said. "Jenny Penn's coming home from the hospital tomorrow. All my boys will be here for the weekend."
"John Harden, too?" Leah asked.
"I got a phone call from John Harden today," Lucy said. "He was in marvelous spirits. He's getting out of the hospital and is coming down to Waterford Sunday to be with all of us."
Then she turned to me.
"John Harden wants to show Leah his treehouse. I'd like to go when you do. I hear it's marvelous what he's done."
"Is John Harden really okay, Mama?" I said. "The last time I saw him, he was holding the whole town at bay at gunpoint, and he seemed a bit overwrought to me."
"You've always been insensitive to John Harden," Lucy said. "You've never taken the time to see the world as he sees it."
"If I could see the world as he sees it, I'd be handcuffed to the same cot at the state hospital, Mother dear."
"Sometimes your humor is in execrable taste, son."
"That wasn't humor, Mother."
"What's wrong with John Harden?" Leah asked.
"He's got headaches," Lucy said.
"He's got bats in his head," I said.
It was almost 7, and there was still light in the western horizon. As we looked out to the sea, a wind lofted off the crests of the incoming waves, creating a dialogue between the palms and barren and iodine taste. The ocean air was heavy and sacred to Lucy, who had come to know what life felt like when it was lived in completely. Her senses blazed like 5 Lenten candles when she stared out into that portion of the ocean that extended beyond their land. I knew she believed the salt air and salt water could save her. The raccoons had already gathered in her backyard garden, clamoring loudly and jockeying for position. In their rowdy banditry, they looked like a pack of miscast hounds, with their arched backs and clownish faces. But they were formidable animals. The back door slammed, and Leah came out with the bag of dried cat food and the leftovers that Lucy had designated for that night's feeding. For 5 minutes, the raccoons chattered and hissed and chased each other until the food was finished and the animals slipped out of the backyard and into the line of trees of an empty lot. When they disappeared, it was like the memory of smoke that had gone.
"When I first came to the Low Country, your great-grandfather told me something I've never forgotten."
"Grandpa Silas?" Leah asked.
"He was my first teacher down here. He shared everything he knew about these islands."
"He wants to teach me how to shoot a deer," Leah said. "But Daddy says great-grandpa's got better things to teach me."
"Silas told me this the first day I met him," Lucy said. "He told me that when the white man first came to these islands, a squirrel could climb a tree on this beach, head west, and not have to touch the ground until it reached the Mississippi River. That's how thick the forest used to be in this country."
"What about the marsh?" Leah asked. "How could the squirrels get across the marsh?"
"Smart girl," Lucy said. "Never take anything at face value."
Dr. Pitts and I had watched the evening feeding from a picture window in the den. There was an odd imbalance between us, as if the generation that separated us was a river of such treachery that no harbor pilot could promise safe steerage through its wreck-filled channels. I could tell that my mother's husband desperately wanted me to like him, and his inarticulate efforts at small talk were the doctor's way of bridging the gap between us.
"Isn't she beautiful?" Dr. Pitts said.
"She certainly is," I agreed, and it took me a moment to realize that the doctor was not talking about Leah.
"She's interested in everything. Got the raw enthusiasm of a girl. Never seen anything to match it. Her energy level is off the charts. I, for one, can't keep up with her. You're damn lucky to have such a mother. Quite a girl. Quite a girl."
I knew that Dr. Pitts was rambling because he was uncomfortable with me. No matter how hard I tried, I could not think of a single thing to say to put the doctor at ease. I let my mind drift through a series of safe subjects—fishing, golf, gardening, inflation, taxes.
but nothing rose up spontaneously to break the silence between us. The effort left me exhausted, but no words took flight.
"Your brothers, Jack, do they talk about me? Do they like me? Any information you could give on this subject would be much appreciated. Also, treated with the strictest confidentiality."
"All of us know you love our mother, Doc," I said. "We are very grateful to you."
"So they're not resentful of my taking command, so to speak?"
the doctor said, as both of us fixed our eyes on the women in our lives. "Dad's an alcoholic, Doctor," I said. "I think that beneath the lake of booze he's consumed since the early 60s, there's a fairly decent man there. But I think he'd have been better off if he'd started drinking gasoline instead of bourbon. It would have killed him faster, and we'd have hated him less."
"Your father called today," Dr. Pitts said. "Again, I'm afraid."
"Why is he calling here?"
"He gets a little tight and then calls to harass your poor mother," he said. "I guess I should step in and put an end to it, but she says she can handle it. She needs all her strength, you know. It doesn't do her much good to spread it around too thinly, especially on nonsense."
"I don't understand leukemia," I said. "Mom seems healthier than she's ever been. She walks 5 miles a day after she wakes up. Her coloring's back. Can she beat this thing?"
"Anything's possible. Body's a funny thing. It's so full of surprises that it makes conventional wisdom seem silly."
"So you think Mom might beat it?" I asked. And I realized that this was the first time I had dared to have any hope at all.
"I prefer to think that your mother'll live forever," Dr. Pitts said, choosing his words carefully. "I simply don't think I could live without her. I have great hope for her because I've got no choice."
"Well, what kind of leukemia does Mom have?"
"The worst," he said.
"Is her doctor any good?" I asked.
"It doesn't make any difference how good he is," Dr. Pitts said, clearing his throat uneasily.
Dr. Pitts walked off to refresh the drinks, and I noticed a slight misstriding, as though my stepfather were trying to conceal a limp. Taking our drinks out, we joined Lucy's attendants to the warming springtime air. Plovers had begun to arrive from South America, rumoring the green tumult that would follow them. We sat on the deck listening to the sea come in at its own pace. The waves moved rhythmically and, as if ordained, like the sands of a moon-brightened hourglass. It was so peaceful and orderly, and I looked fondly at my mother, who had always longed for such rituals of domestic tranquility. The theatrics of pure normality moved her enormously. Lucy was the first to see him coming. She did not give a sign that anything was amiss, but stood up and smoothed out the wrinkles of her dress with her hands.
"Jim, darling," she said, "could you run me quick back to T.T. Bones before the store closes? I forgot to buy the pasta and the bread for dinner."
"Of course," Dr. Pitts said, setting down his drink. "You entertain our guests."
"Let me and Leah ride with you," Lucy said, and I saw her worried glance down the beach.
I looked in the direction she was looking and understood everything without a word passing between us. "Could you pick up a jar of Hellman's mayonnaise for me, Mama?" I said.
"I'll be more than happy to," she said. "Please start the water for the pasta."
I looked at the figure of the man drawing nearer and said, "I'll do that right now. Leah, pick up a dessert that looks good for your lunch." As they went through the house, I walked down the steps that led to the beach. The tide was coming in by inches as I watched my father drawing near, holding on to a pint bottle as though it were filled to the brim with semi-precious stones. His gait was unsteady as he headed directly toward the house and found me blocking his path. We took each other's measure in the half-light of dusk.
"Taking up body surfing?" I asked, "or just out speedwalking to lose weight?"
"I need to speak with your mother," Johnson Haygood said to me without affection. "I need to inquire about the state of her health."
"Her health's lousy," I said. "She's dying. Now beat it, Dad. You scare Mom every time you do this." He looked up toward the house, then back at me.
"I haven't been drinking," he said, lifting the almost full bottle. "I brought this for show."
"Sure."
"My children have all turned like rabid dogs against me."
"Not soon enough," I said.
"You haven't brought your daughter to see me yet,"
he said, in a wounded, self-pitying voice.
"I guess you two have gotten too big for your britches, living in Europe and being entertained by royalty.
Yeah, we're in one Habsburg palace after another, I said, shaking my head sadly. We've been to see you twice, Dad. You were comatose both times.
Well, I've been under a lot of pressure lately, Johnson Haygood said, checking the level of bourbon against the half-lit sky.
What kind?
To quit drinking, he said without irony, but I laughed out loud. You've always hated me, Jack. You were always the leader of those who conspired against me.
Not always, I corrected him. For a couple of years I just pitied you, but hatred came easily after that.
You take Leah to see Charlotte's parents every day. The foxes treated you worse than I ever did.
The foxes tried to take my child away from me, I said. You tried to take my childhood. The foxes failed. You succeeded.
My father looked past me toward the house, where he thought Lucy was watching the scene. He screamed out to her,
Lucy! Lucy! Flag a truce! I need to talk to you!
You're going to embarrass her in front of all her neighbors.
That's always been her weak spot, my father chuckled. She actually cares what her neighbors think. It's given me great tactical advantage over the years. Look, get out of my way. There's a doctor on Hilton Head who can cure your mother. He uses that medicine made out of apricot pits that you can only buy in Mexico.
Yeah, I said. Nobody dies of cancer in Mexico. Mom's already got a doctor. He'll do just as good a job of killing her as anyone else.
He unscrewed the cap of the bottle and took one quick swallow of the old granddad. I had seen my father consume a whole pint of bourbon without coming up once for air. He studied me.
You are the weirdest of all my children, and that's saying something, he said at last. That's a sweepstakes you should take pride in winning. What a happy nest of losers.
And then he said, unscrewing the bottle cap again,
You were born ugly, son. Even I can't be blamed for that. Although you and the rest of them would like to blame me for the ocean having too much salt. No, I had people tell me you were the ugliest baby ever born in Waterford. All red-faced and colicky and runty. Your face has always looked like roadkill to me.
My father's capacity for meanness could always take my breath away. Woe to the child born with freckles, astigmatism, birthmarks, or red hair. He could always find his adversary's softest flanks, and there was nothing he would not say to damage the people he loved most on earth.
"Mom's not here, Dad," I said. "She got Leah and Jim out of harm's way when she saw you coming. She sent me out here to get rid of you." "You and what army?" he said.
I shook my head and said, "Dad, Mom's married now. She's got a new life. You don't need to embarrass her or humiliate her in front of a new husband."
We took vows before Almighty God, he said grandly. The King of Kings, the Lord God of Hosts, the Maker of all things great and small.
She dissolved the vows, I said, with the help of a lawyer. You heard of lawyers?
She deserted me in my time of greatest need. I was helpless, vomiting in every gutter, lifting my arms into the night for an angel of mercy. Alcoholism's a disease, son. Your mother deserted her post like a nurse forsaking a leper. That's why God struck her down with cancer.
I'll tell her. She'll be glad to hear it, I said. Clear out, Dad. Let me walk you back to Grandpa's.
I don't tolerate assholes and degenerates for escorts. I consider you both. I've taken a look at all your pansy cookbooks. I'd like you to know that I wouldn't touch any of that shit during a famine.
I'll write a cookbook just for you, Dad. One chapter will be dry martinis, the next could be margaritas, then scotch and soda, then Bloody Marys.
My father said proudly, I drink my liquor straight.
Well, then I'll simplify the cookbook. The recipe could read, buy a bottle of liquor, open it up, drink that sucker down, throw up in the sand, pass out at your leisure. We could call that recipe breakfast.
Have some respect, Johnson Haygood said. I already told you it was a disease. I need compassion, not censure.
Get out of Mom's front yard, I said, my temper fraying slightly.
I'm not in her front yard. This piece of land on which I'm standing belongs to the literal of the great state of South Carolina. No man or woman can purchase or lay claim to the beach itself, which belongs to the state and the people in perpetuity. Don't argue law with me, idiot child. I'm the best goddamn lawyer you've ever seen, and I've forgotten more about South Carolina law than you'll ever dream about.
You threw your law career away in a bottle of Jim Beam.
I'm a deeper man than you'll ever be, Jack. I drink because of despair, disillusionment, and emptiness of the soul, things you know nothing about.
Because of you, I could give a course at Harvard on all those subjects, I shot back. But let's be clear, you drink because you love to get drunk.
Why should I listen to what you say? My father answered, and there was a new venom in his voice. You're nothing but a faggot who writes cookbooks, a mama's boy who mastered the arts of the kitchen and hearth because he couldn't tear himself away from his mother's skirts. You were always easy to shop for. I'd just think about a nice present for Lucy and buy it for you instead.
I tried to get control of myself again, and I said, I've heard it all before, Dad. You forget everything you say because you're drunk. All of us remember everything because we are sober. The only part you'll remember is me kicking your ass up and down the beach. We've been in this dance for too long. Let's look for another way.
No, I like this way. I needed to express my contempt for you, my utter loathing. Dear boy, you can always pretend you don't care what I say, but you're like the rest of your siblings. You care far too much. I look for things that'll hurt you the most, and then I use them for pleasure. It's a sport I invented. It's my favorite recreation. I call it kid fucking. You find out where they're the weakest. You work away at that spot like a dentist probing at a small area of decay. Go deep enough and you hit a nerve. Probe a millimeter deeper and you can put them screaming on their knees.
Don't do it, Dad, I whispered. I'm warning you.
Ladies and gentlemen, help me welcome to our center stage the lovely and ethereal Shiloh Fox.
I rushed at my father and grabbed him by his throat, lifting him up in the air on his tiptoes. He struggled and tried to hit me in the face with the pint bottle, but I grabbed it and threw it far out into the raging surf.
Your sorrow about Shiloh's all an act, he spat at me. Everything about you's fake. I've watched you walk with your little girl out of the Fox's house. It's so sweet, the loving father, the grieving widower, yet it's all play-acting. If Daddy makes believe long enough, then the whole world will think he loves his little daughter. All I see is your coldness, Jack. I see the Iceman cometh, because I've lived with that cold inside me and it's ruined my whole life.
I'm not anything like you.
You've got me written all over you, he boasted, laughing. All my sons wear the mark of ice that I've been fighting my whole life. Look at poor Dallas, my law partner. He's got a nice wife and a couple of kids, but it's not enough for him. So he goes looking for the first girl who's spread her legs for free, and he thinks he's discovered the mother lode. All of you will be looking for love your whole lives, and you'll never even know when it's sleeping right beside you.
You don't know anything about us, I whispered savagely.
Look up there, Johnson Haygood said, looking toward Lucy's house.
Lucy had returned with Jim and Leah from the store. I watched as she walked up to the picture window, framed in the false light, and peered out into the real darkness. We could see her perfectly, and she could not see us at all.
That's what I lost, my father said to me, because I didn't know what I had. I'll bet you didn't have a clue how much you loved Shiloh until you saw her in the morgue, did you, Jack?
He looked at his ex-wife one last time, then screamed out,
I love you, Lucy. I still love you.
As Lucy fled from the window, he added,
I love you, you monstrous cunt.
Chapter 24 Max and Esther Russoff took great pleasure in the conduct of their business pursuits in Waterford. Max was a wizard at selling, and Esther kept the account books with an infallible accuracy and a penmanship as pretty as a row of tulips. To them, business was an extension of the arts of courtesy and welcome, and anyone who entered their store came as an honored guest. Max was the greeter, the kibitzer, and the joke-teller, while Esther worked behind the scenes in accounts and monitoring the stock. They prospered. Their small food store became the town's first supermarket, and they opened Russoff's department store in the spring of 1937. The department store quickly became famous for its fashions and the fairness of its prices. The first woman to drive from Charleston to Waterford to shop
received a free purse and got her picture in the next week's edition of the local paper. To the Russoffs' surprise, they discovered they were good at marketing and advertising. Everything they touched turned golden, and they could not believe their good fortune or the blessings that God had showered upon them. In 1939, the God of the Jews went into hiding. For years, letters had arrived at Max and Esther's house from relatives scattered throughout Russia and Poland. Esther had been religious about corresponding with everyone who was family, and from the very first days of his residence in Waterford, Max had always sent money back to his family in Europe. In 1939, the letters from Poland stopped forever. The mails grew quiet, and the Yiddish language died for Esther Russoff that year. When Silas McCall learned of the Russoffs' fears for their relatives, he arranged a meeting with the Honorable Barnwell Middleton, the representative from their district in the United States Congress. Hard-nosed and aristocratic, Middleton sat in Harry's restaurant in Waterford in October of 1941 and stared at the weathered face and enormous arms of Max Russoff. Silas McCall sat beside him as Max told of the disappearance of his and Esther's families when the German army entered Poland and then invaded Russia. When Max had finished speaking, he handed the congressman a list of all their relatives, their names and addresses. There were 68 people on the list, including 4 infants. Middleton cleared his throat and took a sip of black coffee before he spoke.
"It's a bad time, Max."
"What do you know?" Max asked.
"That it's bad, that it's worse than you think, that it's worse than anybody thinks."
Silas interrupted angrily. "God damn it, Barnwell, the man's worried sick. Don't make it worse until you know something for sure."
"It'll be bad news, Max, whatever I find out."
"We are Jews," Max said. "We have had bad news before." Over a year passed, and the Russoffs heard not a single word from Barnwell Middleton. By then, the United States was fully engaged in the war. Max had heard no news at all of Kieranitska's Jews, and the silence that had first fallen on Poland now fell on Russia. It was the year that their 2 sons, Mark and Henry, enlisted in the United States Army. Sending their sons off to fight the Germans made Max and Esther Russoff feel like Americans as nothing else ever had. Max had given both boys miniature replicas of the Statue of Liberty when they were shipped overseas, and they kept the small statues on their persons for the entire war. They fought as American soldiers with great fierceness and resolve, and as the sons of the great Jew, they were unafraid of Cossacks. They fought north toward the Europe where the collective voices of all the Russoffs on both sides of the family had fallen silent. In the middle of 1943, Barnwell Middleton met Max and Silas for lunch for the first time since he had promised Max he would try to find out the fates of his and Esther's families. For the first 15 minutes of the meal, Barnwell talked about the progress of the war, the victories and defeats of the Allies, and the somber mood in Washington. Silas listened impatiently, then said, "Get to the point, Barnwell."
"Have you been able to check on our families?" Max asked.
"Yes," Middleton answered, his voice grave. "I wish I hadn't received any answers, but I have."
Then Barnwell leaned across the table and took Max by the hand and held it fiercely as he delivered the news from Eastern Europe in a South Carolina cafe known for its bad coffee and good pie.
"Max," he whispered, "all the names you gave me, all of them, all dead, Max. Every one of them is dead."
Max said nothing. He neither tried to speak nor thought he could utter a sound if asked a direct question.
"There's no way for you to know that," Silas said. "It's wartime. There's confusion. Armies in the field. You can't know for sure."
"You're right, Silas," Barnwell conceded. "Some of these people could have escaped or been overlooked. Some could have hidden. The information was a long time in coming. I'm not even sure where it came from or who retrieved it. The source is in Switzerland, and I know he's German. That's all I know. He says that all your family is dead, Max. All of Esther's family is dead. There are no Jews in any of the towns or cities you gave me with the list of names."
"Judenrein," Max said at last. "They're killing every Jew they can find," Barnwell said.
except the ones they're forcing into slave labor. Your family was mostly slaughtered in fields. The Jews were forced to dig their own pits, then were machine-gunned en masse.
There were four infants, babies, Max said.
The Germans aren't particular, Barnwell said.
They machine-gun babies? Silas asked.
Or bury them alive after they kill their mothers, Barnwell said. There was one teenage girl they thought was Esther's niece. She's in hiding in Poland. But it turns out she only has the same name as a girl on Esther's list, Ruth Graubart. A shame. It turns out she's no relation at all.
What happened to this child's family? Max asked.
Barnwell shrugged his shoulders and said, I suppose the same thing that happened to yours. They said the Polish underground could smuggle her out.
Then you should do it, Silas said.
The price was a tad high, Barnwell said, his voice ironic and detached. They were asking for $50,000 cash.
Silas whistled, and Barnwell released Max's hand at last.